You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC. I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here today for Leonard Lopate. Like nearly every contentious issue in American politics, whether it's climate change or Wall Street reform or, well, you name it, the outcome is often determined by which side is better financed. That's also the case when it comes to gun control. Those in favor of gun rights have a huge cash advantage over gun control advocates, who often come up dramatically short in the money arms race. We're joined now by ProPublica reporter Suvan Lee, who has followed cash flows in the gun debate, and I'm pleased to welcome her to our program today. Hello.
Hi.
Just how large is the financial gap between the two sides in the gun debate?
Well, Julie, it's pretty significant. Gun rights groups have a significantly higher spending advantage than gun control groups do. And you can tell from just the recent filings in the 2012 election.
Now, as you say that, can you describe what those figures are on one side and the other?
Sure. For instance, in the last election cycle, we saw the NRA, for instance, give $1 million to federal candidates and federal campaigns. On the flip side, we saw the entire gun control interest lobby spend a little over $4,000.
What accounts for that dramatic gap between $1 million on one side and $4,000 on the other?
Well, if you're looking at these at this issue as two sides of the issue, gun control and gun rights on opposite sides of the issue, we see the National Rifle Association as the oldest gun rights group having a significantly high membership base. We see them having a deep grassroots organization, a deep base from which they can draw upon, a lot of membership dues and fees that are being contributed to the organization. So we do see that there is a lot of membership that they can pull from.
And on the other side, is there the same kind of organization?
Well, that's an interesting question, because we know that the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, for instance, as the oldest and the largest gun control group, they certainly will push issues out there. They'll certainly campaign and advocate in favor of gun control legislation. But when it comes to spending, we're not seeing the type of high numbers that the NRA is pulling from their members.
In terms of the money that they're taking in, the financing that they're taking in.
Exactly.
We've had a string of horrific events. We just heard one in the news just a moment ago about shootings in Connecticut and Colorado and Arizona and Wisconsin, just to name a few. Have any of these events helped to boost fundraising for gun control groups?
Well, that's an interesting question, because gun control groups will present some of their financing activity, not in terms of the timing of such events, but we could definitely see in the near future such groups providing more information about how such events have spurred a greater deal of donations to their organizations. And it depends on how they break that down to release to the public.
Nearly all of us are familiar with the NRA, which you mentioned before. Are there other groups that are fighting on the side of gun rights?
For gun rights, certainly the NRA isn't the only pro-gun group out there today. We see other groups such as, the Gun Owners of America. We see National Shooting Sports Foundation. We see Safari Club International. There are other gun rights groups out there. They might not necessarily have as big a membership as the NRA does. They might not be as old as the NRA is, but we are seeing them do more lobbying. We are seeing them donate money to political campaigns. So the NRA is certainly not alone in its efforts.
And on the other side, the Brady campaign, which you mentioned, is the most well-known. Are there other organizations that are fighting for gun control?
Sure. In recent years, we've seen, for instance, Mayor Bloomberg come forward with his personal money to finance the Independence USA PAC, for instance. We also see a coalition called Mayors Against Illegal Guns that has also been pretty instrumental in giving money to campaigns in 2012, and also spending money in terms of electioneering communications to try and defeat certain candidates.
Now, the total amount of campaign contributions by gun rights groups last year, according to the figures you had, was $3.13 million. And of that, 96% went to Republicans. Is the allocation of that money based on the ratings that the NRA puts together?
I think because the NRA rating system is such an integral part, I think, of their operation and is a way for the public, at least, to understand how the NRA either backs or opposes a lawmaker. Certainly, the rating system is a pretty significant element of how the distribution of money occurs. So when you do see the high percentage of NRA spending going to Republican lawmakers, and chances are that those lawmakers will undoubtedly favor legislation that either supports gun rights or aims to scale back restrictions on gun control.
I'm speaking to Suvan Lee from ProPublica, who has examined where the money comes from and where it goes in terms of the issue of gun rights and gun control. With such a large percentage of this campaign cash going to Republicans, why don't Democrats just simply write the gun industry off as hostile and pursue it more aggressively?
I think it's a pretty delicate issue. As we know, the gun rights issue goes way back in this country. The Second Amendment is certainly an issue around various groups and coalitions, and the entire gun industry has been intensely lobbying and litigating against for many, many years. The Supreme Court as well, with its, twin decisions in both 2008 and 2010, bolstering the one's right to own a gun in the home and applying that to all states, has also come into the mix. So when we do ask the question of why Democrats or other lawmakers don't more vigorously pursue gun control, I think we have to look at, this deep history and this legacy that the Second Amendment and the issue around it has in this country. So we'll see whether the latest Connecticut shootings might provide a further impetus for some more reform in Congress.
The Second Amendment is an amendment that goes way, way back, as you said, but has been interpreted in different ways over the centuries.
Sure.
And so these two Supreme Court rulings, do you see those as having tremendous effect on this issue?
Well, from what legal experts have so far interpreted from, these rulings, it could mean two things. We will see gun control groups, we will see gun rights groups take what they will from the language of these majority opinions. However, I think underneath it all, the Supreme Court did say that, people have a right to own guns in the home. However, states also do have a right to, impose their own restrictions. It's not an unbridled right. There are certainly avenues in which state legislatures can impose their own rules to keep it at a safe level for the public.
I'm speaking to Suvan Lee. She's from ProPublica, and we have links to her articles on our show page at WNYC.org about political spending by advocates on both sides of the gun debate. She's also written about states that have loosened their gun control laws in recent years, and we'll have more after a break. Later on in the show, Joyce Carol Oates joins us for this month's Leonard Lopate Show Book Club. We've been reading her novel, The Grave Digger's Daughter, and if you have thoughts or questions on the book, you can share them now on our homepage. Plus, Ayanna Mathis talks about her debut novel, The 12 Tribes of Hattie. I'm Julie Burstein, in today for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.
WNYC receives support from Roundabout Theater Company, presenting Picnic, written by William Inge and directed by Sam Gold, now in previews. Tickets and more information at roundabouttheater.org. The New School, hosting a professional and continuing education open house night, providing information about undergraduate degrees for adults and transfer students. Tuesday, January 8th at 6 p.m. More at newschool.edu/openhouse. LV Wood Floors, specializing in custom pre-finished wood flooring and reclaimed wood flooring made to the client's specifications, all sustainably made in the USA. The New York City showroom on 20th Street between 5th and 6th Avenue is open to the public. LVWoodFloors.com.
At WNYC, we'll always stand by you, giving you the facts when you need them most. Breaking news that's sometimes tough to hear. Connecting you to people across the city and around the world. Bringing your voice into the mix. Because sometimes it's good to listen, and sometimes it's great to be heard. WNYC. Never turn it off.
I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here for Leonard Lope today, and I'm speaking with Suvan Lee from ProPublica about the article that she wrote about where the money lies in the gun control, gun rights debate. Suvan, in this article, in this wrap-up of all of the different funding, one of the things you mentioned at the beginning is that while the gun rights groups have contributed quite a bit to campaign funding, gun control groups only contributed $4,000 last year. Why do you think that figure is so low?
I think that figure is so low for a couple of reasons. One, I think there is just a stark difference between the amount that the gun rights lobby is spending. So when you see those two figures side by side, sure, there's a pretty stark difference. Therefore, making, you know, $4,000 to federal campaign contributions sound like nothing at all. But I think also there's just, you know, perhaps a different type of mission here. I mean, I think the gun control groups really do have a huge industry they're fighting against when it not only comes to gun rights groups, but, you know, gun manufacturers, the entire gun industry, $11 billion annual industry. So I perhaps they are spending their resources in the ways they feel is most wisely spent, whether that's going out there and educating the public, whether it's campaigns, advocacy work. Perhaps they feel that's the best way to dole out their money. However, you know, gun control groups perhaps will have the best explanation for the disparity there.
When you looked at the figures for the Brady campaign, for instance, where did you see their outlays of their funds go? What was from looking at where the money goes, what did you see about their strategy?
Sure. You know, they have spent their money elsewhere. You know, they've actually spent some funds lobbying Congress, so they aren't certainly shirking that part of their operations. But we are also seeing other gun control groups come into the fold. So I believe there's also some partnership work going on there. Perhaps there's some, you know, leadership roles. Perhaps there is some guidance for these emerging gun control groups that have emerged. And, you know, we have yet to see how the latest shootings might shift their strategy, you know, in the coming months.
How did Citizens United and the change in Super PAC rules affect the flow of money in this issue?
Sure. I think that one element of the funding that we haven't quite heard about yet is all this money when it comes to electioneering communications, and that of course is advertisements that don't specifically advocate for one specific candidate, but it might mention the issue, and certainly we don't know how much the NRA has spent or other gun rights groups have spent when it comes to that. So when we post Citizens United, you know, there's a lot more money that could be being spent out there, and the donor is not having to be disclosed. So there's another area, gray area, in which the public just has not gotten the full picture.
Has it also opened up avenues for gun control advocates such as Mayor Bloomberg, who there was a lot written about the way that his PAC supported gun control candidates.
Absolutely. And I think the, you know, for instance, Mayors Against Illegal Guns, you know, they certainly have used their funds to put out their electioneering communications. So it's not just gun rights groups. We are seeing gun control groups take advantage of that, absolutely.
Clearly, a large part of this discrepancy has to do with where these organizations get their funds. Is it possible to know where most of the NRA's revenues come from?
Well, we know that in 2010, from which the last tax filings were publicly available, they drew in about $228 million. A little less than half of that came from membership dues and fees. The NRA is estimated to have about 4 million members nationwide. So you can see from that proportion alone, they are drawing a lot from their membership fees. We also do know that they have allied with, you know, gun manufacturers and gun companies out there that have participated in a corporate giving campaign. So the more these studies come out, the more we can understand where they're funding, where exactly it's originating from.
Since President Obama took office, the National Rifle Association has waged a massive public relations campaign claiming that President Obama is after guns. Let's take a listen to Wayne LaPierre of the NRA from a talk he gave last February.
All that first-term lip service to gun owners is just part of a massive Obama conspiracy to deceive voters and hide his true intentions to destroy the Second Amendment during his second term.
Is this rhetoric based in reality from what you've seen, or is it a really good way to stir up campaign contributions?
Right. I think from the clip we've just heard, you know, I think a large part of it is rhetoric, but we have seen certainly a lot of, you know, anti-Obama rhetoric from the day he took office from the pro-gun rights groups. You know, that said, I don't think the president has formally been presented with any proactive legislation necessarily when it comes to gun control legislation. So in that respect, you know, I think his record has yet to be established in a more concrete, sort of tangible way. However, in his first 4 years, you know, Congress has passed legislation which has included, you know, certain measures that have maintained, as you would say, the status quo when it comes to gun rights in this country.
I remember there were some bills about carrying guns in national parks and on Amtrak trains, and both of those were passed.
Sure, those are two examples. Absolutely, you know, Congress passed a bill that allows you to carry a loaded firearm into a national park in those states that have the same state-level rule in place. Amtrak as well, you can carry a concealed firearm while checked into your luggage on the train.
Ah. Not on your person, but in your luggage.
No, not on your person, just in your luggage.
This gets at the complicated issue of states' regulations about firearms, which is also something that you have investigated. What happens in those instances? You know, I think about an Amtrak train. You get on the train in one state, and you may end up in another state. What happens then in terms of those regulations?
Sure. Well, in the case of Amtrak, you know, as long as the gun is tucked away into your luggage on the train, then that's going to be maintained nationwide as long as you're on the rail, as long as you're on the car on the rail. But when it comes to state-by-state laws, yes, absolutely, it's a patchwork of laws. And this is how gun legislation works in this country. There are certain federal benchmarks in place, but, you know, every state has their own laws set in place. So when it comes to the, you know, interstate commerce, when it comes to the movement of firearms around the country, It gets a little confusing, and understandably so, because every state is pushing their own laws through.
Recently, The West Wing has come to Netflix, and I've been watching it with my kids because they were too young to watch it at the beginning. And we just saw an episode from 1999, which felt just like it could have been filmed today in that it was about trying to pass gun control legislation, and it was about the senators who were against it and the senators who felt that it didn't go far enough. And it made all of us start talking about, have things really changed over the past 15 years, say, mm-hmm. in terms of gun control issues?
Mm-hmm. Sure. You know, I think it depends whom you ask. Mm-hmm. I think the, you know, lawmakers who are really adamant about the issue on one side of the issue or the other will tell you, sure, it has. I mean, I think pro-gun lawmakers might say, well, we've certainly put in place all these new restrictions, the assault rifles ban, for instance, while other lawmakers who are for more gun control might tell you, no, we've not nearly gone far enough, and we certainly need to reinstate, to renew the ban, or introduce other measures. So yes, it's a deep-seated issue, and I think it really depends whom you ask.
The Small Arms Survey estimated that in 2007, in the United States, there were 88 guns for every 100 Americans, which means we have the highest gun ownership rate in the world. And the country that comes in second at 55 guns per 100 people is Yemen. In your research, did you come up with anything that could indicate why we're such a heavily armed society?
You know, I think that many people in this country feel that, you know, they have a right to bear arms, and it might not even be a one handgun per household scenario here. Households might, or individuals might, you know, own more than one. So it's a complex question, I think, that has a complex answer, and I think you really have to look at the roots of this country and just other cultural issues to give a full sense of full explanation for that question.
Let's talk about some of the ways that gun laws have been relaxed. In Missouri, it's no longer a crime for an intoxicated person to handle or fire a gun so long as they were acting in self-defense. But I guess a question could be asked, how can a person who is intoxicated know whether they're acting in mm-hmm. self-defense or some other emotion?
Yeah. And I think the self-defense exception, you know, has always been in place. However, lawmakers specifically wrote in and sort of codified this exception when it comes to intoxication and firearm possession and use most recently in the past few legislative sessions. So I think what that indicates is that, sure, one always has a right to defend themselves through whatever means possible, if it means doing it in a way that you're not committing a crime against another by perpetuating it. But in the case of Missouri, you know, we are seeing this as an example of how they're introducing a way for firearms to be more of a standard, I guess, a standard method, standard way to protect oneself.
In an article last year for The New Yorker about contemporary gun laws, Jill Lepore wrote, "When carrying a concealed weapon for self-defense is understood not as a failure of civil society to be mourned, but as an act of citizenship to be vaunted, there is little civilian life left." And so I guess the question is this the society, if we look at the money, that people want?
Is this a society that people want?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think now that we've seen all these types of stand your ground laws being passed in states in which one has a right to use force against another as long as in any public place he or she has a right to be without retreating first, you know, laws that really do revolve around the right of gun ownership in this country and having concealed carry laws expanded in certain states, you know, It's a weighty subject. You know, people feel extremely strongly about the right to carry concealed weapons in all sorts of venues, whether it's a bar, whether it's a place of worship, whether it's, you know, just a neighborhood community center. It's you know, it's definitely an issue that people feel very strongly about, their right to simply carry a concealed gun.
Yesterday, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos, "The biggest problem we have at the moment is spending and debt. That's going to dominate the Congress between now and the end of March. None of these issues will have the kind of priority that spending and debt are going to have over the next 2 or 3 months." So do you think that the issue of gun control, even though after the Newtown shootings, there was such an outcry and also a call by President Obama to examine this issue. What do you see as possibly happening over the next couple of months?
I think it really depends on how forcefully President Obama's, you know, the circle of advisors and those around him push for this issue. I think the momentum certainly hasn't gone away. I don't think that, you know, even 1 month after the Newtown shootings occurred, the discussion should go away. I think people out there who are keeping a watch on this issue, whether it's the media, whether it's advocates or other organizations who feel strongly about this issue, shouldn't and won't let this issue kind of, you know, dissipate. I think that despite the discussions around the debt and other political issues that some lawmakers might think take precedence, you know, right now, yesterday, the Washington Post came out with a good article about how, you know, Vice President Biden is now going to soon present, maybe within the next several weeks, measures to strengthen gun control in this country. So we'll see where that goes.
So I know you write articles, not television shows, but if you were to be writing an episode of The West Wing set right now, what would you see as happening over the next few weeks? Where would those conversations be happening, do you think?
Well, I think the conversations could be happening anywhere. I mean, they could be happening, you know, just, you know, behind closed doors, from lawmaker to lawmaker, with lobbyists, with the types of gun control and gun rights individual representatives that they've been talking with all along. But perhaps those conversations might be lengthier this time. Perhaps they might be a little bit more urgent. Perhaps we'll see a little bit more, you know, force and a sense of urgency to sort of infuse this issue with the kind of momentum it needs. And perhaps we'll see more of that in the coming weeks.
I've been speaking with ProPublica reporter Suvan Lee about the political spending by advocates on both sides of the gun debate. She's also written about states that have loosened their gun control laws in recent years. And we have links to those articles on our show page. Suvan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Julie.